14 Voices of Normality je podcast realizovaný Bratislava Policy Institute, občianskeho združenia, ktoré si kladie za cieľ reagovať na súčasné spoločenské trendy doma aj v zahraničí. Moderátorská dvojica Viera Žúborová a Michal Vašečka budú vo svojom pravidelnom podcaste hovoriť spolu so spisovateľmi, historikmi, filozofmi, sociológmi a verejne známymi osobnosťami, dokonca aj s niektorými politikmi. Budú sa ich pýtať na ich názor, čo si myslia, že sa deje. Demokracia cíti tlak všade. Čo sa môže stať ďalej? Aké zlé by to mohlo byť? Bude to spoločenská diskusia, ktorú by mali viesť všetci. Pripojte sa k nám.
Today we are going to discuss development of outbreak of coronavirus in Italy. I would like to introduce Professor Emilio Coco, who happens to be a friend of mine, who studied at Bologna University in London. We are together co-organizing Summer Institute in Dubrovnik. And Emilio is expert on various issues, on ethnicity issues, minorities, and also something what is completely unknown to people in Slovakia, maritime sociology. Since we don't have a sea, we cannot really understand all those well-hidden issues of maritime sociology. So Italy was obviously the first Western country which was imposing very severe restrictions on movement to fight back the illness. But after 2 weeks, the curbs were imposed, the disease is still spreading, and hospitals, especially in the northern part of the country, are visibly collapsing. We all see it in TV, but maybe we don't understand really the situation, how it looks like in a country. So, Emilio, how Italians are really reacting on COVID-19 crisis? What is changing in Italian society? How would you describe the situation as a sociologist?
Yeah, hi, Michael. Thanks for this video call. And I'm going to try to give you my perspective, although I have to say that the situation is kind of evolving very quickly. And so I guess mine could be just speculations, but I'm going to try to give some, you know, sociological background, you know, to my claims, you know. So first of all, I'd like to remember, you know, like 1 month ago that I went to Milan for like just like a weekend trip. And then after a week, I flew to London for 3 days, you know, library work, you know, the usual stuff that, you know, scholars would do, you know, the break between the two semesters. And then, you know, all of a sudden, in a few days, I found myself quarantined and locked down in my home, you know. And I remember that 1 month ago, there were 3 coronavirus cases in Italy, in Rome, which is the city where I live now. And 2 of them, there were 2 Chinese tourists. And another guy was an Irish guy. You know, they were, you know, in the hospital. There's like a very big hospital for like tropical disease in Rome, you know, built in the 30s, you know, at the time when Italy was a colonial power, at least tried to be, you know. And so it was built to, you know, to host people that got malaria or this tropical disease. So the Irish guy eventually, you know, was dismissed because, you know, he had the pneumonia but was not positive to coronavirus. So just 2 people, 2 Chinese. An elderly couple that actually recovered like a few days ago and was sent back to China, you know, successfully. So we all had the impression that this coronavirus was just something like the SARS or, you know, any other, you know, tropical disease, you know, that, you know, we could, you know, easily, you know, like practically, but also in with a sort of imagination exercise, you know, relegate somewhere very far away, you know, in Asia or in Africa. It wouldn't touch us, you know, for real. And if someone had it, you know, they were probably those Chinese immigrants, you know, and they were, you know, I have to say, even some cases of, you know, like very bad behavior with the, you know, Chinese people. They were, you know, treated, you know, like in bad manners, you know, even Philippines people, you know, and the usual stuff that, you know, when the foreigner is, you know, like pointed at as, you know, like the one that is bringing, you know, like this is in the country. And then, you know, very, very quickly, we found our country and mostly, I have to say, the northern region of Lombardy to be the epicenter of a global pandemic. 80% of, you know, cases of people infected and unfortunate people that died, you know, in Italy, they are in Lombardy or in Emilia-Romagna or Veneto, but mostly in Lombardy. So it is very concentrated, you know. If you look at other regions in Italy, it's not that big issue. And this is, you know, like pushing me to reflect, why is that, you know? Because why is in Lombardy, not in London or in Frankfurt or any other places? I guess, you know, it was probably some sort of a perfect storm. A combination of, you know, ski season, combination of, like, people that actually, you know, went back to visit, you know, like, parents in other regions, and then they came back to Milan, which is, you know, Lombardy, one of the three regions in Europe with the highest density of people, and is the industrial and financial engine of the country, and also, you know, hosts, you know, 2 to 3 very big, you know, airport. One of that, you know, in Bergamo, which is, you know, the area mostly, you know, like affected by the virus. It is also the European hub of Ryanair in the European continent. So a number of reasons that, you know, put people to mix up and created, you know, all the conditions for the virus to spread. But also, I have to say, probably some errors, you know, made politically, you know. I can just figure maybe 2 out, but there might be more. One is the, you know, the overconfidence of the local authority to treat a virus that, you know, was considered to be some sort of flu, nothing more than a bad flu. And, you know, interestingly, you know, in sort of paradox, you know, it was in Lombardy that is probably the region with the best health system in Italy, and probably one of the best health system in Europe and in the world, you know, like an extended network of hospitals, like up-to-date, you know, machinery, engines. So they were ready. And this combined with the attitude of Italians, which is, you know, an attitude that tends to go to the hospital, you know, for whatever reason, especially elderly people, you know. If you are sick, you go to the hospital because the hospital is there and the universal healthcare system is, let's say, one of the pride of Italy, you know. And remember that Italy is one of the few countries, if not the only one, that set public health as a duty for the, to the state in the constitution. So together with education and, you know, human rights, public health, you know, is, it's a duty, you know. So everybody is, has the right to be healthy and to go to the hospital. So I guess that at the beginning, everybody went to the hospital, and hospitals were simply not ready to tackle, you know, the virality of this very bad disease. So hospitals functioned as multipliers of disease, you know. And, you know, I remember a very strong U-turn at one point, you know, from the day that the mayor of Milan and the governor of Lombardy were telling to people, oh, we're going to be like stronger than the virus, you know, we're going to use all of our resources, intellectual and technological resources, you know, to tackle the virus. Milan is never going to stop. Milan is the engine of Europe and all this kind of rhetoric. After 1 week was, you know, stay home, don't move, lockdown. And, you know, we turned, you know, from, you know, a Western, you know, progressive narrative of cultural and technological hubris, you know, that we are, you know, more advanced, more strong than the virus, to a Chinese model, you know, very, very, you know, quickly, you know, with people like asking the government to intervene. So if the week earlier was, we can do it alone, we can handle it, the week after was, you know, government, please come in, army, please come in, you know, police, please do your job. And so a very big U-turn, a very big change. And but I guess, unfortunately, that was a little bit too late, because it was implemented most of all in the area of Lombardy, so-called red zone, and had a very bad side effect, because, you know, overnight, many, many people just flew out of the country. Milan and that region was abandoned, and many people went back, you know, to their regions of origins, mostly in the south, so that this disease was spread all over. Now, we can claim, and probably, you know, an external observer might have all the rights to say that was, you know, a bad management of the situation. But let's remember that Italy was the first country in Europe to deal with such a rapid, you know, escalation of the disease. We moved, you know, like step by step, try to do the best, also making errors and try to, you know, make up the errors. And we are talking about, you know, very serious decisions taken in matters of days, you know, like not in months, you know, in a country that usually takes, you know, like 3 years to make, you know, a very simple decision. Very important decisions were made in a matter of like 3 hours, maybe not 3 years. And also, you know, to me, it was very interesting as a political sociologist how the central state was back, you know, at the center of the stage. Not the financial crisis, not the migration crisis, not the climate change, not the crisis of, you know, like a currency of the euro, but this one, you know, has actually been the real factor that brought, you know, like the power of the central government and, you know, the nationalism, you know, involved into it back at the center of the stage, you know, because now you see a lot of Italian flags all over, you see patriotism, you see people very, you know, like loyal to the institutions, not necessarily in a bad way, you know, because there is no enemy. The enemy is the virus, it's not, you know, like the neighbor or, you know, like, but still, you know, it's the same kind of an enemy.
Emilio, let me interrupt you, because you mentioned something about the mentality of Italians, and this is being discussed also in Slovakia, that what contributed, I mean, and the question is whether this is just some kind of stereotype, that what contributed to the spread, very quick spread of the virus, especially in the northern part of the country, is the mentality of Italians who are very touchy, you know, who love to touch each other. They are kissing each other a lot when they meet each other. You know, so there are these type of stereotypes which are explaining the situation and very quick spread. Is it true? Is there something about these stereotypes which we can use? Because this is something what we can hear in Slovakia very often, that simply Mediterranean nation, which has certain habits that we in the northern part of Europe don't have, or central European part of Europe don't have. So we will be not affected so much as people in Mediterranean area. Is there something about it?
Well, I don't know, because it is sometimes very tempting to try to explain social phenomena through, you know, moral lens, you know. So if a country, let's make another example, just to make myself clear, you know, let's take a country that is not performing very well economically. Oh, well, that's because, you know, the weather is warm, so people are lazy or things like that. Or, you know, because, you know, mentality is not, you know, like pushing them to work very hard. Okay, I'm not denying it 100% that there might be something, you know, like in the way people behave that explains. But just is not enough, because remember that Milan is the city in the north. And so if it was Sicily, you know, and Milan, you know, with lower rate and Sicily higher rate, then I will say, oh, maybe you have a point, you know. But I can see that not just in Italy, but in Europe, you can create a geography that follows this rule, you know. Second point, I mean, I don't think that, you know, if you squeeze yourself in a wagon on the London Underground or the Paris, you know, Metropolitan, you are keeping a social distance that, you know, is like a stronger, like a bigger than, you know, like the one taken in Italy, in a small town, you know, in Lombardy. Probably the only thing that is true is that Italian families are seeing more often, you know, a promiscuity between like elder generation and younger one. So in other words, it's more common maybe for like a teenager to visit grandparents. But again, I don't know if this is not the same maybe in Slovakia, you know, if you go to the rural area, if you get into a cafe or in a cavana or like a pivnica, maybe you find people drinking all together and singing. Then, so social distance, you know, it's really depending maybe on the place and on the situation more than the country. Kissing, yes, could be something, but probably, you know, if we want to use more, you know, like objective, you know, demographic and sociological indexes, could be the density of population in Lombardy. And I guess, you know, the multipliers effect of places like hospitals where people maybe they were not, you know, considering very seriously, you know, the situation. So I guess there was maybe a bit of arrogance, you know, saying that, you know, probably, you know, but that's my guess, you know, of course I don't have any way to prove it yet, but I guess at the beginning, people, they were not believing that, you know, something like in China or in South Korea could happen in a European country. And I do really hope that, you know, in other countries, you know, things will be much better than in Italy, you know, because now I hear a lot of, you know, references to Italy as a negative example. Oh, yes, you failed, as you say, so we can do it better. But let's talk in a couple of months, you know, because an epidemic, you know, is not following the same, you know, timeline. So you might just be, you know, 1 month, you know, before. I hope really not so. And I really hope that, you know, Slovakia is doing all the possible things to prevent it. But, you know, we never know. Let's look at Spain, you know, like 1 week ago was basically nothing. And now it's raising, you know, very much.
Thank you, Emilio. You confirmed my objections to all those theories that the character of Italian nation is behind a very quick spread. What might be the case is probably to a certain extent that the percentage of young Italians who are living with their parents is relatively high in comparison to some of other Western countries. I remember that it's 66% people in the age 18 to 34, these are Eurostat statistics from 2018, who are still living with their parents compared to 48% as a European Union average. That might explain something, but probably not so much as many people, let's say in Slovakia, believe so. But what is happening in a society? How society is reacting on it? And let me explain why I'm asking. Some environmentalists in Slovakia are now discussing that basically this pandemia was inevitable from environmental point of view. Various Christian groups are discussing that this is a punishment for our sins and visibly society is boiling, you know. We are discussing how this happened. So what's the situation in Italy in this sense? Who is going to be blamed for the situation at the moment?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, I guess, because it reveals how often we actually use moral arguments to explain you know, scientific matters, you know, and let me just remind here, you know, Mary Douglas and, you know, famous book about risk and blame, or, you know, how institutional things, you know, where to direct the arrows of accusation, you know, so who's to blame for something, right? Because, you know, that's probably part of human nature, you know, to blame, you know, morally people for their behavior in order to explain, you know, like fatalities or, you know, negative events. In Italy, you know, there was a very interesting, you know, negative, you know, description of people that were considered at the beginning of this story, you know, like liable or guilty because they went to the mountain to ski, you know, for vacation. So stories such as, oh, yeah, you had the nice time up there in Tirol or Cortina or in the Dolomites, and now you see what happens, you know, if you don't stay home, you know. Some sort of like a class struggle style, or, you know, idea of, oh, yeah, you like to go out and drink, you know, aperitif, you know, instead of staying home. And that's what you so attaching like a bad moral, you know, value to maybe behaviors that are, you know, connected to mobility, you know, cosmopolitanism, globalization. So in a way, there was a little bit of this narrative, I guess, in Italy, too. Before there was a narrative that was attaching, you know, Chinese immigrants, you know, okay, oh, Chinese, they brought it because, you know, they're eating bats and they are like barbarian people and they brought these, you know, terrible things to us. Then was moving to, you know, like people, they were like having those mobile patterns of life and these were considered to be bad, you know, like because they're traveling, they're going abroad, they're like mixing up things that should not be mixed, you know, like... But that's, I guess, is the same thing, you know, like as you were mentioning, you know, Italians, they, within brackets, you know, deserve it because they are kissing each other all the time, because they're always, you know, like embracing. Yeah, I mean, we can find many reasons why, but the truth is that, you know, the virus spread, you know, through the air, and then before or later, we are all going to get sick, you know, like, I guess. The problem is with the health system. I guess there was like a very strong underestimation of the impact that the virus could have on the health system. And remember, the health system of Italy is this, in terms of like capacity, is the second in Europe after Germany, you know, together with France. So it is not a bad one at all. You know, like we have a lot of, you know, beds and intensive care units, up to 5,000, 6,000 beds, you know, which is like France, you know. And so if you exclude Germany, they have like a super capacity of 20,000. Then after that is Italy. But, you know, after 1 week, it was already in strain, you know, it could not cope with this, because the problem with the virus is that many people, they need intensive care. So it is purely a political issue, you know, a government issue that, you know, I guess no one could expect, you know, with such, you know, intensity and ferocity. I'm not always a great fan of my government, but I cannot say that this time they were acting, you know, in such a bad manner. You know, they did in other occasions, but this time, really, you know, I also appreciated, you know, like the rapidity to which they took decisions. You know, like I didn't like very much the fact that, you know, regionalism was, you know, creating, you know, some sort of different standards depending on the region, because the health system in Italy is regionalized, so it's sort of going through federal tracks. You know, so you have like health system in Lombardy, health system in Sicily, and they're taking different decisions. And this, you know, like regionalization wasn't working very well, you know, with this pandemic act. And again, this was the reasons to bring back, you know, the power of central authority to take, you know, like in their hands, you know. So, I mean, Italy had the bad luck to be the first one to be confronted with something. And, you know, surprisingly, in the region that was the most developed in terms of like health system. And probably because of that, you know, the crisis was so bad, you know, because I guess that if this was, you know, began probably in another region, like a mountain, you know, rural region in the south of Italy, in the central of Italy, it wouldn't have been such a bad issue, you know, because probably, you know, the virus wouldn't have circulated that much, you know. So I don't know. I cannot judge, you know, to what extent, you know, the negative, you know, development of the crisis depends on bad decisions, or unfortunately, it could be just a matter of time. So in other words, Italy has been the first, but the same thing would happen, you know, exactly the same way in other countries, just maybe slower, you know, maybe if social distancing is applied, you know, and more seriously and more in advance. And also depends, you know, countries that are less populated, countries where, you know, like young people, they tend to live alone. And also, you know, like the ability of the authorities to force people to stay home, you know, because this might be interesting for you, like to understand about Italy, that the prescriptions of the government that force people to stay home, they are working much better in the south than in the north. And again, this is going against, you know, the stereotypes about discipline, you know, and self-control, you know, because you would expect people in the north to be more disciplined, you know, and people in the south to be more anarchic. But actually, it doesn't work like this, because people in the south, they usually have like larger families, and, you know, they stay home more, you know, like relaxed than people in Milan, that maybe, you know, families are smaller, made of one person or maybe a couple, and they live in smaller apartments, and they also, you know, they're more used to go out to dine or to lunch or to do whatever. So to stay home, it's much harder to them than to someone in Naples that anyway stays home much more than people in Milan, you know. So, I mean, I don't want to say that regional and cultural differences do not play a role, but I would be very careful, you know, like in explaining, you know, the way the pandemic develops, you know, according to cultural, you know, like frames, because, you know, culture, as you know better than me, you know, like it's really, you know, changing according to the perspective, you know, you put them. I mean, it's hard to say, you know, there's a cultural, you know, factor behind it. But of course, you know, locally, it might explain something, you know, but also it could be exactly the opposite.
Yeah, Emilio, so you mentioned the central government, and of course, Italy, besides all those regional differences and peculiarities have a tradition in the past of deeply centralized government. And, you know, with a certain smile, of course, from time to time, you can hear from some Italians that under Mussolini, everything was functioning so well. So do you expect that the situation might be utilized by Salvini or eventually somebody else to centralize country even more? And now I'm referring, of course, to ideas of Michel Foucault that epidemic is in a way a dream of every authoritarian ruler, you know, because they can utilize it for imposing various changes in a society that look at the first time that they are temporarily imposed, but in fact they might remain forever. So. Mm-hmm. Do you expect something like that happening in Italy? After all, you had, you know, 6 governments in 5 years. So something can be changed in your country very quickly. But is there a danger that it might have this kind of, you know, almost fatal consequences?
Well, I think this is the real point, you know, I guess, you know, at the end of all discussion is, you know, when this epidemic will take, like, you know, the lower turn and will go towards the end, you know, what are we going to do? Are we going to go back to the usual business as before or not? Okay, so leaving beside, you know, the tradition of Italian government, because it's true that, you know, in Italy, there's like this trend of changing government very, very quickly. But on the other hand, if you look at, you know, the composition of the parliament and the longevity of politicians and, you know, the power of the president of the republic, you would have like a different picture, you know, that Italy is also a very stable country with a long continuity, you know. So there's a lot of change, you know, on the surface, but deep inside, you know, the hidden structure of the Italian governance are the same, you know, and there's a very long continuity, you know, in the last 60 years. So Italy is only apparently, you know, like a shaky country, but, you know, it is also very resilient, you know, and that's why, you know, it's always there, you know, like, whatever, you know, happens, you know, no big changes, you know, like really happen. This one, it's really a big challenge and, you know, it's producing changes, real changes. As you mentioned Foucault, I remember I read, you know, like another, you know, biopolitician, you know, and talking about biopolitics and, you know, reflecting on the ideas of Foucault. And he was, you know, a few years ago at the time of the SARS epidemic, you know, imagining, you know, in Europe, in Italy, actually, you know, with the pandemia and, you know, the way the state of emergency would have, you know, like produced, you know, reaction in the government. And if you read his article, which I'll be happy to send it over if you want to read it, you know, it is amazing the way, you know, he's, you know, describing things exactly as they are now, you know. Now, what is the problem? From my point of view, from what I look around and what I hear people saying, is that, you know, there's also a positive side in this, you know, in a country like Italy, because Italy is a country that, you know, in the last 20 years experienced, you know, this, you know, frustration for not being able to do, you know, in terms of government, what they really wanted to do, you know, because there's a lack of money, because the public debt is very high, because, you know, European rules are very strict, you know, so you have to follow, you know, some sort of a predetermined set of actions that is decided in Brussels more than in Rome. People that getting a lot of consensus, like Salvini you were mentioning, they are just proposing, you know, recipes that are impossible to apply. So it's really, you know, like a situation where you find yourself stuck, you know, you can't find a way out, because either you stay within the cage of the EU or you follow people like Salvini that are basically selling dreams that are impossible to come true, like, you know, getting out of the Eurozone or things like that. That's, you know, everybody knows that this is basically impossible to realize. So this epidemic is giving, you know, some real, you know, path to follow, to do things that actually people like, you know, because when the state, you know, is turning, you know, abandoned barracks or abandoned hospitals, abandoned hotels into places, you know, to do something good, like, you know, healing, you know, the sick people, or where you see that, you know, collecting garbage, it is something much more efficient now because people are cleaning up streets. And, you know, a city like Rome is not a chaos, but it's actually very clean, you know, with less people around and, you know, police is around, no robbery, no thieves. This is, you know, producing, you know, some odd feelings of, you know, like well-being, you know, even into people that have a very strong democratic faith. So you don't have to be a fascist to appreciate, you know, that the state is back, you know, like, and is performing functions like, I don't know, controlling mobility, controlling, you know, like security. So what the migration crisis was unable to do, what the climate change was unable to do, well, this pandemic has actually produced, you know, like created, you know, the conditions for the national state to be back, you know, as a character, as a protagonist of, you know, the everyday life, you know. So you see police around, you see, you know, like people doing their job, you know, in terms of like cleaning up streets, in terms of like controlling. Now you see, you know, like people that are appreciating the work of, you know, like the hospitals or the doctors, the postmen, you know, civic heroes, you know, this rhetoric that was long time, you know, like lost, you know, in a country like Italy that is, you know, was living, you know, a much more, you know, realistic, let's say, less poetic way, you know, it's civil life now, it's is experiencing, you know, things that, you know, they were like long lost, you know. Of course, you know, people are just 2 weeks now locked down. Maybe in 1 month they're going to be, you know, completely mad and, you know, they want to go back to the ordinary life. I mean, think about, you know, teenagers or people that are losing, you know, their school year. It's very hard to them, you know. For an adult, maybe, you know, you can survive. But, you know, for kids, young people, you know, they cannot see friends, they cannot see parents, relatives. It's very hard, you know. But I don't know if it's possible to go very quickly back to the usual business, you know, like because this is a virus that unless you find, you know, like a cure, like a vaccine, is going to be there all the time. So the state of emergency can be prolonged, you know, forever, especially if this is an excuse within bracket to spend a lot of money, you know, public money, to put public money into the market. And let me just, you know, this adding this final note, you know, and this is also a moment where all the worst, you know, like liberal and progressive nightmares about the EU are coming true, you know, because we all know that the EU is a wonderful, you know, machine, you know, when it comes to good times. So it's actually multiplying and, you know, like strengthening, you know, the forces of the ones that are already strong, you know, like, so is creating efficiency, is creating, you know, is putting, you know, like the best people together to be even better, you know. But when it's a bad time, you know, it's a time of solidarity, it's a time, you know, to, you know, share, to make sacrifices. We saw it with the crisis and Greece in 2008. No one wanted to make any crisis for anyone else. And again, you know, with the migration crisis, you know, no one wanted to take any single share of another country. So when it's the moment of, you know, fear, when it's the moment of, you know, like sufferance, then the nation state proves to be, you know, the only institution that people rely upon, you know, and you find national flags and you realize that if Sicilians have a problem, it's the people in Milan, they're going to save us, and the other way around. It's not the Slovaks that are going to solve the problem of Sicilians. And this is unfortunately something that is in the back of everybody's mind, even people that love EU, you know. It's not a matter of being against the EU. It's just that, you know, in cases like this one, you realize that maybe we have to change something in the way the EU is functioning when it comes to the crisis. Because I remember the very first days, you know, there were rumors, I don't know, this sort of like Facebook news, so I'm not sure if they were like true or not, but I mean, still, there were things that people were discussing in the social media that like France or Germany were blocking, you know, like a German or French industry producing, you know, masks because they didn't want them to sell masks to Italy, you know, because they want to keep those masks for their citizens, okay? And Austria and Slovenia closing the borders with Italy, you know, as this is like, you know, a way to without, you know, like consulting with Brussels. So these are things that are very serious, I guess, you know, and we have to, you know, seriously reflect on that, because if we don't take this opportunity then to, you know, strengthen, you know, the EU and make the EU more democratic, then I'm afraid, you know, that the solution to go back to the nation state is the only one. We hear in Italy, I don't know about Slovakia, but in Italy, there are stories like, you know, Ferrari or Pirelli, you know, those champions of national industry, converting, you know, their industry to produce like ventilators, masks, hospital machines. So like in wartime, you know, so your industry is producing your stuff for your people, you know. So, and that's, and this is, I'm afraid, a very big threat to the European common market. I mean, I don't know what you think about it, but...
Yeah, well, Emilio, you are ending the whole discussion with a rather negative negative message. But this is really something what we are all preoccupied. Also in Slovakia, we are somehow lacking more involvement of the European Union. Although the truth is that the European Commission changed their relatively reluctant position to a rather active one. But it came relatively late, you know. So again, what will be remembered will be a relatively slow reaction of the European Commission. That's true. Well, Emilio, we can continue this discussion definitely for hours. I don't want to keep you from your family. And let's hold our fingers crossed that we will come out of this crisis, well, relatively untouched, in a sense that all those liberal virtues that that we cherish still will survive, and we can eventually return to, as you said, business as usual, although the world will be probably not the same. Yeah. Thank you very much.
No, thank you. I mean, I didn't want to sound very negative. I mean, I'm optimistic at the end, just that, you know, probably things won't be the same, exactly the same as they used to be. But I guess that maybe, you know, we can learn some lessons and, you know, maybe even be better than we used to be, you know, like. So, yes, I mean, I'm optimist. I have faith that this is like not destroying, you know, the liberal, you know, like setting that we are living. We're not going to turn ourselves into subjects of dictators. I'm really, you know, confident, you know, like, just be careful. I mean, this is what I'm saying.